The Saffron Robe by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read to you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC, January 2017. This is Chapter 9. I stood on the storehouse roof, standing high above the surrounding ground. Before me stretched the whole of the Valley of Lhasa, green and beautiful, with the colored houses and the blue of the turquoise bridge. Farther, the golden roof of the Cathedral of Lhasa gleamed brightly, standing erect as it had stood for centuries, weathering the storms. Behind me, although at this time I did not turn my head, was the Happy River, and beyond, the towering range of mountains with the passes leading up ever higher and descending through great gorges, great canyons, until one could turn one's head and see the last of Lhasa. Then straighten up and carry on in the direction of India and to see part of Nepal, part of Sikkim, and part of India stretched out in front. But that was commonplace to me. I knew all about it. My whole attention now was riveted on the city of Lhasa. Below me, to the right, or rather almost directly below me, was the Western Gate, the entrance to the city, thronged as ever with beggars crying for alms, pilgrims hoping for a blessing from the Holy One, and traders. As I stood there, shading my eyes against the harsh light so that I could see more clearly, the rising voices carried their message to me, "Alms, alms for the love of the Holy One! Alms that in your house of distress may be given aid to." Then from another direction, "Oh, this is a real bargain. 10 rupees only. 10 Indian rupees. And you can have this precious bargain. You will never see the like of it again, for our times change. Or, I'll tell you what, you've been a good customer. Let us make it 9 rupees. You give me 9 rupees now, and I will pass this over to you, and we part good friends." From the ring road, just below, the pilgrims were going along, some stretching their length, rising and stretching their length again, as if that peculiar form of locomotion would give them some salvation. But others walked erect, gazing at the rock carvings, the colored rock carvings, which was one of the most beautiful features of this mountain. As they came into sight, I could hear them muttering, "Oh, there is someone on the roof there staring out. Do you think it is a llama?" The thought almost made me laugh. I, a small boy, standing aloft with the wind fluttering through my ragged robes. I, a llama? No, not yet, but I would be in time. The pilgrims muttered away at their eternal "Om Mani Padme Hum." The traders tried to sell them charms, prayer wheels, amulets, and horoscopes. Most of the horoscopes, the charms, and the amulets had been made in India and imported, but the pilgrims would not know that. Nor would they know that none of these things had been blessed in the manner promised. But does not that happen in all countries, in all religions? Aren't traders the same everywhere? I stared out from my lofty perch, staring out in the direction of Lhasa, staring out, trying to penetrate the light haze which was formed by the yak dung fires being lit to warm the houses, for a nip was coming to the air, The weather was definitely worsening. I looked up at the snow-laden clouds racing overhead, and I shivered. Sometimes it was remarkably hot, perhaps 40 degrees Fahrenheit at this time of day, but then, by night, it would drop far below freezing. But not even the weather was of much concern to me at this particular moment. I eased myself, trying to take some of the weight off my elbows, which I rested on the wall in front of me, and I stared and stared until my eyes ached, and until I imagined that I saw that which I desired. At one time I started up in high excitement. A llama in a scintillating saffron robe was coming into sight. I started up in such excitement that my treacherously weak legs betrayed me, and I toppled back, knocking the wind from me, and making me gasp for seconds before I could scramble to my feet again and peer on in the direction of Lhasa. But no, the wearer of the saffron robe was not the llama whom I sought. I watched him riding along with his attendants, watched him enter the ring road there, and saw the pilgrims make way for him and bow in his direction as he passed. Then, after half an hour or so, he came up the path before me. As he did so, he looked up and saw me and made motions with his hands, which I correctly understood to mean that my guide would be coming shortly. This was a kindness, and a kindness which I greatly appreciated, because high llamas were not much in the habit of paying attention to small boys. But as I already had good reason to know there were llamas and llamas, some were remote, completely austere, withdrawn from the emotions of life, while others were jolly, always ready to help another, no matter his rank or age or situation in life, and who was to say which one was the better, the austere or the compassionate? My choice was the compassionate man, who could understand the miseries and the sufferings of small boys. From a higher window, a window which I could not reach because I was just an acolyte, a head protruded and looked down. The face had a mustache. I bowed my head reverently, and when I looked again at the face, it had vanished. For a moment or two I stood in contemplation, hoping that I had not caused annoyance by climbing up here onto this roof. As far as I knew, I was not breaking any rules. This time I was trying desperately hard to behave and not do anything which would cause me to be delayed in seeing my guide when he returned. Over at the slightly higher Shakpori, I could see monks going about their business. They seemed to be going in procession around the walls, and I thought that no doubt they were giving thanks that another batch of herbs had arrived from the highlands where they grew. I knew that a party of monks had recently arrived from the annual herb gathering in the highlands, and I hoped that before too long I would be a member of such parties. From afar off there came a trail of smoke. I could see a small group of men milling about. Presumably they were brewing their tea so they could make sampa. Traders, that was clear, for there was no colored robe among them, just the drab colors of traders, and these all wore their fur hats. The chill wind was growing once again. Down below, traders were gathering up their goods and scurrying for shelter. The pilgrims were crouching on the lee side of the mountain, and the beggars were showing remarkable agility. Some, in fact, even forgot their pretended illnesses as they hurried to get away from the approaching sandstorm, or rather, dust storm. The valley of Lhasa was habitually swept clean by the gales which swept down from the mountains, blowing everything before them. Only the larger stones remained in place. Dust, grit, sand, all were swept away. But with every high wind, fresh sand and dust came upon us, sand borne by great boulders which had been rocking and swaying in the mountains, and then, perhaps, had collided with some other rocks and shattered, forming pulverized stone, which, becoming windborne, swept down upon us. The wind, so suddenly having arisen, pressed hard against my back, plastering my robe tightly to the stone wall in front of me, pressing so hard I could hardly move. Grimly I clung to the wall, trying to get finger holds, trying to let myself sink down so that I should be a bundle on the roof and thus afford the wind little grip for it to lift me. Painfully I let my knees fold. With infinite caution I lowered myself so that I could form a tight ball with my face and head protected from the stone-laden gale. For minutes the wind howled and shrieked and seemed to threaten to blow away the mountain itself. The wind howled louder than any of our trumpets ever blared, and then on the instant, remarkably, strangely, there came complete silence, a dead calm. In the silence I heard a sudden laugh, a girl's laugh from somewhere in the bushes. "Oh," she said, "not here in this holy place, that is sacrilege." Then a giggle, and a young man and a girl sauntered into view, hand in hand, as they crossed towards the western gate. I watched them idly for a few moments, and then they strolled out of sight and out of my life. I stood and stared again, over the tops of the trees along in the direction of Lhasa. But the storm had left us, and it was now at Lhasa. The view was blanked out. All I saw was a great cloud like a gray blanket held to intercept the view. The cloud was featureless, but it was traveling rapidly. It gave you the impression of two gods, each holding the end of a gray blanket and running with it. As I watched more and more, buildings became visible. Then the nunnery itself on the other side of Lhasa became visible. And the cloud went on receding rapidly down the valley, becoming smaller and smaller as it did, as the wind forces became spent and the heavier particles of dust and grit fell. But I was watching in the direction of Lhasa, not a silly dust cloud which I could see at any time. I rubbed my eyes and stared again. I tried to force myself to see more than was really there, but in the end I saw a small party of men just appearing beyond some buildings. Some of them were wearing saffron robes. They were too far away for me to see individuals, but I knew. I watched enthralled, and with my heart beating more rapidly than it was wont. The little group of men rode on sedately, not hurrying, an orderly procession. Gradually they approached the entrance of the turquoise bridge, and then were concealed from my gaze by that beautiful enclosed structure until they appeared again at the near end. I stared and stared, trying to imagine which was which. Gradually, with painful slowness, they came closer and closer. My heart leapt within me as at last I could recognize the one saffron robe in whom I was entrusted. I tried to dance with joy on the roof, but my legs would not permit me, so I braced my arms against the wall again in an unsuccessful attempt to control the trembling of my limbs, trembling more from excitement than from weakness on this occasion. The little cavalcade grew closer and closer until at last they were hidden from me by the larger buildings of the village of Sho beneath. I could hear the clatter of the horses' hooves. I could hear the rustle and grate of harness and the occasional squeak of a leather bag being pressed, perhaps between rider and horse. I stood on tiptoe and tried to make myself taller so that I could see more. As I peered over the edge, I could just make out heads wending their way up the stepped path towards the main entrance. Briefly, one in the saffron robe looked up, smiled, and waved his hand. I was too overcome to wave back. I stood there and stared, and trembled with relief that soon he'd be with me again. A word was said to another lama, and he too looked up and smiled. This time, I was able to force my features into a rather trembly sort of smile in return, because I was overcome with emotion. I could feel emotion welling up inside me, and I was desperately afraid that I was going to break down and prove that I was not a man. The little cavalcade mounted higher and higher, making for the main entrance to the Potala, as was right for such an august party. Now, as I well knew, there would be a little delay because my guide would have first to go to the inmost one and make his report, and then he would, in the fullness of time, make his way to his own rooms in the higher portion of the Potala, whence, after a suitable interview, he would send a boy in search of me. I slithered down from my post and dusted my hands and knees and tried to make sure that my robe was fairly presentable. Then I made my way to the little house on the roof, entered it, and very carefully and slowly climbed down the ladder to the floor below. I had to make sure that I was available whenever a messenger came in search of me, and I wanted first of all to make sure that I was as tidy as I could make myself. Our ladders were rather hazardous contraptions for anyone who had any leg troubles. They consisted of a substantial pole, well smoothed, and with notches cut on each side so that one put one's leg, or rather one's foot, on the left side, and then one put the right foot to a higher notch on the right side, and one climbed up in that manner with the pole between one's knees. If one was not careful, or the pole was loose, one would slip around to the wrong side, often to the great glee of small boys. A menace of which had to be wary of was often the pole ladders would be slippery with butter, because when one climbed a pole with a butter lamp in the hand, often the butter which had melted would slop and add to one's problems. But this was not the time to think of ladders or butter lamps. I reached the floor carefully dusted myself off again, scraped a few dabs off of congealed butter, and then I made my way into the boys' part of the building. In our dormitory, I walked impatiently to the window and peered out, kicking my heels against the wall as a sign of my impatience. I peered out, this time out of sheer boredom, for there was nothing I wanted to see outside. The one I wanted to see was inside. In Tibet, we do not use mirrors. Not officially, that is, because mirrors were considered a vanity. If any person was caught looking in a mirror, it was considered that he was thinking more of carnal things than of spiritual things. It was a great help in keeping to this attitude that we had no mirrors. On this particular occasion, however, I urgently desired to see what I looked like, and so I made my way surreptitiously into one of the temples, where there was a very shiny copper plate. It was so shiny that after I had rubbed the hem of my robe across it a few times, I was able to look into the surface and get an idea of what I looked like. Having looked hard and long and feeling heartily discouraged at what I saw, I put back the plate and made my way in search of the barber monk, for I was looking like a blackhead. In Tibet, blackheads are people who are not in holy orders. Monks and all those coming under acolyte, trapa, monk, or monastic orders shaved their heads, and so they were frequently known as red heads, because that is what we had when the sun did its worst. On the other hand, lay people had their heads covered with black hair, and so they were known as black heads. It should be added here that we also referred to saffron robes when we meant the higher lamas. We never said the wearer of the saffron robe, but only saffron robes. In the same way, we talked of red robes or gray robes, because to us the robe was the thing, as indicating the status of the person inside it. It was also clear to us, by Tibetan logic, that there must be a person inside the robe, or the robe would not be able to move about. I made my way deeper and deeper along the sloping corridors of the Potala, and then at last I approached the rather big room where the barber monk plied his trade. He was one who was called a monk by courtesy, because it seemed to me that he never left his particular room, and certainly never attended services. I strolled along the corridor and entered his door. As usual, the place was filled with hangers-on, shiftless monks who hung about. The barber monk, the kitchen monks, in fact, anywhere where they could skulk and just waste their own and somebody else's time. But today, there was quite an excited air about the place, and I looked to see the reason. On a low bench, there was a pile of remarkably tattered and torn magazines. Apparently, one of the monks had done some service for a group of traders, and the traders, out of the kindness of their hearts, had given him a whole load of magazines and papers which they had brought for various purposes from India. Now there was quite a throng of monks in the barber monk's room, and they were waiting for another monk who had spent some time in India and thus could be presumed to understand what was in the magazines. Two monks were laughing and chattering over some pictures in a magazine. One said to the other laughingly, "We must ask Lobsang all about this. He should be a specialist on such things. Come here, Lobsang." I went over to where they were sitting on the floor, looking at pictures. I took the magazine from them, and then one said, "But look, you have the magazine upside down. You don't even know which way to hold the thing." Unfortunately, to my shame, I found that he was right. I sat down between them and looked at the most remarkable picture. It was of a brownish color, sepia, I think the correct term would be, and it depicted a strange-looking woman. She was sitting on a high table in front of a bigger table, and on a framed affair on the bigger table there was a picture, or reflection of the woman. Her dress really intrigued me because it seemed to be longer than a monk's robe. She had a remarkably small waist, which appeared to be belted tightly to make it even smaller. Yet her arms were heavily padded, and when I looked at her chest, I found myself blushing with embarrassment because her dress was remarkably low. Dangerously low, I should say, and I found to my shame that I wondered what would happen if she bent forward. But in this picture, she was keeping a rigidly straight back. As we sat there looking at the picture, another monk came in and stood behind us. We took no notice of him. One of the people milling around said, "Whatever is she doing?" The monk who had just entered bent down and read what was written beneath, and then he said grandly, "Oh, she is merely making up her face. She is applying lipstick, and when she has done that, she will use eyebrow pencil. That is a cosmetic advertisement." All this confused me beyond belief. Making up her face? Putting on lipstick? Putting on eyebrow pencil? I turned to the English reading monk behind me and said, "But why does she want to mark where her mouth is? Doesn't she know?" He laughed at me and said, "Some of these people, they put red or orange around their lips. It is supposed to make them more attractive. And when they have done that, they do these things to their eyebrows and perhaps to their eyelids. And when they have finished with that lot, they go on and put dust on their faces, dust of various colors." All this seemed very strange to me, and I said, "But why hasn't she got her dress on, covering the top part of her body?" Everyone laughed at me, but everyone took a jolly good look to see what I was getting at. The English reading monk laughed loudest of all, and he said, "If you see these Westerners at their parties, you will find that they wear very little on their chests, but a very great deal below the waist." I pored over the pictures, trying to understand what they were all about. I did not see how the woman could move about in such uncomfortable clothes. She appeared to have no feet, but the cloth went all the way down to the ground and trailed behind her. But I soon forgot all about that when I heard the English reading monk telling others about the magazines. "Look at this one. The date says 1915. There's a very great war on in the West, and it's going to envelope the whole world. People are fighting, killing each other, and they dig holes in the ground, and they stay in these holes, and when the rain comes, they nearly drown."
"What is the war about?" asked another monk.
"Oh, never mind what the war is about. Western people don't need any reason to fight. They just fight." He turned over a few magazines and then came to another. It showed a most remarkable thing. It seemed to be a great iron box, and according to the picture, it was running over the ground, running over soldiers who were trying to escape.
"That," said the English reading monk, "is the latest invention. It is called a tank, and it might be a thing which will win the war."
We looked, and we thought about the war. We thought about all the souls getting injured when their physical bodies were destroyed. I thought of how many sticks of incense would have to be burned to help all these wandering souls.
"The British are raising another battalion of Gurkhas, I see," said the monk who read English. "But they never think of asking for any spiritual assistance from Tibet."
I was rather glad they did not, because I could not see any sense in all the killing, all the bloodshed, all the suffering. It seemed so stupid to me that grown men had to squabble and come to blows just because one set of people could not agree with the other set of people. I sighed and shook my head in considerable exasperation to think that it was my unfortunate destiny to travel to the Western world later. All that had been foreordained, my future, had been told to me with extreme clarity, but I did not like any of the things that had been told to me. It entailed too much suffering, too much hardship.
"Lobsang," a voice bawled at me. I looked up. There was the monk barber, motioning for me to come and sit on his three-legged stool. I did so, and he stood behind me and picked up the huge blade with which he shaved our heads. He did not use soap or water, of course. He just made a few strokes with the razor blade across a piece of stone, and then, grabbing my temples firmly with his left hand, he began the painful process of scraping off the stubble from my skull. None of us liked this process, and we all expected to end up with a bloody head, with the head nicked, chopped, and gashed. However, Tibetans are not soft. They do not run screaming at the first trace of pain. So I sat there while the monk barber scraped and scraped away.
"I suppose I'd better trim your neck, eh?" he said. "Understand your guide has returned. You'll be wanting to rush off, eh?" With that, he shoved my head down almost between my knees and then scraped industriously at the long hair where my head joined my neck. All the time he kept blowing at me, blowing off the hair which he had cut, and each time, if I guessed the right time, I held my breath because his breath was, well, not pleasant. Apparently his teeth were rotting or something. At last, though, he finished his scraping, and we started to mop up the blood from the numerous scratches. Someone said, "Quickest way to stop that is to put a piece of paper on each scratch. Let's try it." So I ended up looking something like a scarecrow, with little three-cornered bits of paper stuck to bloody patches. I had nothing better to do for a time, so I stayed in the barber monk's room and listened to all the conversation. It seemed that matters were in a very bad state in the Western world.
It seemed that the world was just about aflame. There seemed to be trouble in Russia, trouble in England. The Irish people were making a commotion. Only we of Tibet were peaceful. I fell silent as I recalled the prophecies which had been made about Tibet centuries before, and I knew that in our time, in my lifetime, in fact, we of Tibet would have our own troubles. I knew also that our own beloved Dalai Lama would be the last actual Dalai Lama, and although there would be one more, he would not be of the same spiritual significance. Idly, I turned over a page and saw a most extraordinary picture. It seemed to consist of a lot of boxes with pieces cut out of the sides, and out of the sides, people's faces were peering. The boxes were all joined together, and they seemed to be drawn along by some monster which was belching smoke. There were circular things beneath the boxes, and there seemed to be two lines between them. I could not at all make out the significance of what it was. I did not know at the time that they were wheels, and what I was seeing was a train, because in Tibet the only wheels were prayer wheels. I turned to the English reading monk and tugged at his robe. Eventually he turned to me, and I asked him to tell me what it said. He translated for me that it was a British troop train taking soldiers to fight in the fields of Flanders. Another picture fascinated me and thrilled me beyond all explanation. It was of a contraption that appeared to be a kite with no string keeping it in touch with the ground. This kite seemed to be a framework covered with cloth, and in the front of it there seemed to be a thing which, by the representation of the picture, must have been revolving. And I saw that there were two people in this kite, one in the front and one sitting close behind. The quite friendly English reading monk told me that it was an airplane, a thing that I had never heard of before. I resolved that if I were ever expelled from the lamasery or from the order, I would not be a boatman, but I would instead be one of those people who flew those strange kites which they had in the West. And then, as I turned those pages, I saw another thing, a thing which frightened me speechless for a time. And that was a feat in itself, for this thing appeared to be a long tube covered with cloth or some sort of material, and it was shown as if flying above a city and dropping great black things on the city. Other pictures showed the black things landing, and showed a flash and damage as buildings flew up into the air. The monk told me that it was a thing called a zeppelin, which was used to bomb England, and that a bomb was a metal canister filled with high explosives, which blew everything from its path when it landed. It seemed to me that these magazines had nothing of peace in them. They were, instead, dealing only with war. I thought that I had looked enough at those pictures, which merely served to inflame men's angry passions, and so I put the magazines down, made my thanks to the English reading monk and to the barber monk, and I made my way upwards again to the dormitory, where I knew I could soon expect a messenger. The endless day drew on. Once again it was time for Sampa. I went down into the hall and had my meal with the others, but I confess, the day was endless, endless. I had little appetite, but I thought I should take an advantage and eat while there was still time. Having cleaned my bowl, I left the dining hall, made my way up again to the dormitory, and stood, for a time, looking out of the window, watching the bustle that surrounded our buildings. End of chapter 9.